I'm Michelle Brandt, and today I'm talking with Larry Cohen, Executive Director of the Oakland-based Prevention Institute. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
So your organization argues that prevention strategies shouldn't focus on individuals. It's just as important to take into account the social and physical environment. Can you talk about how a person's environment can impede wellness?
Sure. We certainly understand that our physical environment affects our health. And I think, you know, everyone's very concerned when we're talking about the soil food is grown in, the water we drink, if it has toxins, you know, or when the air is polluted. You know, we understand and are concerned about the health outcomes from these kinds of things, from lead poisoning to cancer to asthma. But a lot of the health problems we're facing today are not linked to the physical environment, but to behaviors. To what we eat, what we drink, whether we smoke, whether we get enough physical activity, sleep, recreation. And at first look, it probably appears that we each make and are fully responsible for our own health decisions and for influencing the decisions of our kids and our families. And while there's certainly truth in this, we don't make decisions in a vacuum. So just as the air, water, soil affect health, so does our community environment. You know, neighborhoods with more availability of fast food and junk food or less fruits and vegetables have higher rates of consumption of healthy food. You know, places where smoking is the norm maintain higher rates of smoking than the places where smokers are pushed outside into the rain. And I think we have, you know, we know this, we've known this for a while, that changes in the environment that improve access to healthy food, for example, opportunities for physical activity, do make people healthier. So we built our work at Prevention Institute around the idea that interventions at the community level can be the most effective ways to prevent illness and injury. And the evidence exists almost everywhere. Neighborhoods with the highest prevalence of chronic disease, you know, tend to lack the essentials of a healthy environment like walking trails, you know, open spaces, streets with places for pedestrians and bicyclists, green spaces, fresh and affordable fruits and vegetables. And we're starting to even build the evidence base around this link quantitatively. So it's getting increasingly clear, increasingly visible about that social environment as well as the physical environment and its links with health and wellness.
In the Stanford Medicine story, you mentioned the importance of making the healthy choice the easy choice for people. So how can we do that? And what do you think are the most effective ways to enact preventive measures and improve community health?
Yeah, yes, we do. We really have the responsibility to make the healthy choice the easy choice, really like walking downhill rather than the effort of climbing up. We need to create a community environment that cues people toward health choices. It's important, I think, that we take a comprehensive approach. When I say cueing people toward healthy choices, what I'm talking about is the power of norms in affecting the ways in which we behave. How do we create healthy norms? How do we create healthy cues? I think it starts, of course, in the environment and looking at the key institutions that shape our environment, the businesses, government, healthcare, schools, faith-based organizations. You know, policymakers have a tremendous amount of power in shaping and in changing norms. I can think of lots of examples where policy changes the simple choices we make and has a huge impact on health outcomes. Kids never rode in car seats. Policymakers passed a law requiring car seats, and now virtually no infant is ever seen not in a car seat. In addition to car seats, think about helmet laws, think about tobacco, think about lead poisoning. You know, I helped to shape the nation's first multi-city tobacco laws. It was in Northern California, and we started with no smoking in workplaces, only in private offices, and in 40% of restaurants. So those changes alone, they probably wouldn't have had much impact on health, though, of course, every place we reduce the amount of smoke is a bit helpful. But the power comes because changing the environment starts to change the norms. And now, as I said earlier, we see smokers standing outside in the rain rather than us having to stand outside to get a breath of fresh air. That's how we make the healthy choice the easy choice.
You recently commented that the government has a vested interest in keeping people healthy. The government already spends millions, even billions of dollars on medical care, but
yes.
Where does prevention fit in?
Well, you know, you're right. The government spends lots of money treating illnesses and injuries. In fact, we spend billions in medical treatment every year. It's the highest per capita expenditures in the world by far. Yet what we see is a healthcare system that's crumbling. And if we realize the important goal of providing health care for everyone in this country, and it's crazy not to from a moral perspective, as well as, by the way, from an economic perspective, waiting till people get sick. But if we increase health care to health care for everyone, I think the current health care system is apt to implode. You know, we already have too long wait times in emergency rooms, medical visits, basically, they're speed up, there's no opportunity to talk to our healthcare providers, and the rates of doctor and nurse job satisfaction are plummeting, the number of nurses available plummeting, you know, not nearly enough. And then, of course, the incredibly unjust inequities where low-income people and people of color too often get no or unacceptable levels of care, all this with the highest per capita expenditures in the world, as I said. So prevention is key here. You know, if we could reduce or eliminate unnecessary illnesses and injuries, the system could then take care of the people who really need care. But yet the investment in prevention, it's minuscule. And most of the investment is not in quality prevention. People confuse prevention with brochures or health fairs. You know, all they think about is education. And what prevention is about, needs to be about, is about communities where people can be active without fear or worrying about safety, where they can walk to public transportation and relax on the way to work rather than sitting in these long, stressful traffic jams, breathing asthma and cancer-producing air. You know, communities where fruits and vegetables are what subsidize to make them more affordable, instead of subsidies for ingredients and sodas and subsidized supersized burgers. You know, so, you know, we're currently looking here at the economics of prevention in a project we're doing for the California Endowment. And we're working on constructing frameworks and models that allow organizations, you know, to start to understand how to work together, how to invest, and then to reinvest in prevention. You know, prevention has not been well documented yet. The cost-benefit analysis of prevention needs to be better established because government needs to see that the best investment indeed starts with prevention. But separate from cost-effectiveness, you know, while government is spending these billions of dollars, isn't it preferable to spend some of it before people get sick and injured and do it in ways that also helps the people who are ill, the people who are injured, to be better able to manage their illnesses and live more productive lives? It's not that government needs to spend more money by any means. It's that they need to spend their money smarter, and they need to spend their money with more balance with what's really, really causing the diseases and the injuries.
Well, assuming that preventing illness and injury is a good investment, do you think that the cost savings argument is one that would resonate with the average person?
I think that people really understand prevention. You know, the general individual likes prevention. Everybody tries to practice it on an individual level. We don't always succeed, but I think everyone tries. But the average person, and many leaders, in fact, don't have a good understanding of how we translate that prevention notion to what government and healthcare can do on a broader level. They're just thinking about the brochures, maybe about immunization or screening. But I think if people start to understand that prevention is mostly about creating community conditions that promote health, and that this is doable and cost-effective, they're really going to be pleased by that. You know, like I said before, the cost-saving argument can be one of the most compelling arguments. Policymakers, of course, they're also concerned about costs. And when they're thinking about the healthcare system, typically they're just thinking about the medical system. So we need to educate our policymakers to be more sophisticated. The cost savings from prevention not only reduce direct medical costs, they reduce a lot of other costs. They reduce workers' compensation, productivity. They have a wide array of economic benefits that come from better health, let alone the benefit of just not being sick or injured, you know, which is pretty obvious, I think, and the value and the morals of that. You know, so now is a time when businesses are being asked to foot increasing parts of the medical care bill. And that's an opportunity, I think, because if we can give them information about savings and productivity, this information becomes increasingly relevant. And the businesses will increasingly demand more effective and more cost-effective healthcare. Healthcare, not medical care, just healthcare, which includes prevention.
Polls show Americans think research on preventing disease is actually more valuable than research on curing and treating disease. So I'm wondering, why do you think only 4 cents of every healthcare dollar goes towards prevention?
It's really unacceptable. But remember, the decision makers about healthcare tend to be doctors and medical researchers who are driven by, frankly, a medical paradigm, which is an old way of thinking. It emphasizes almost entirely acute diseases and medical conditions that result from people's genetics and biology. So most of the research, whether it even if it's the research related to prevention, you know, or the research about treatment, will look at individual biology, how to modify it with some pills, injections, or maybe even genetic modification. But many of the issues we see emerging when we say, why are people sick? Why do people have chronic conditions? What's going on that's keeping so many people ill and such our expenses going up so much? We're seeing chronic conditions that have more to do with behaviors and environment. And so the investment needs to be very, very different. And keep in mind, you know, money. It's easier to make money with a new drug, and unfortunately, it's money that drives many of our decisions. And, you know, it's subtle because most of the policymakers and politicians don't have those financial incentives. Nevertheless, who are they listening to? Who are the big voices in our country? Who is the media listening to? It's medical researchers, it's pharmaceuticals, it's healthcare organizations, and they're all doing very, very well in this current situation in terms of their bottom line. You know, there was a quote from, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, that obesity is a side effect of things that are good for the economy. And in fact, from the medical perspective, perhaps the obesity is good for some of those medical economies. But it's not good for us as individuals, and it's not good for us as a society, either in the cost or in the misery that we're talking about. And, you know, we're not going to see the change of investment, you know, just from leadership from pharmaceutical companies or medical researchers. You know, we really need to speak to it as a community. And frankly, when we see a change, and I hope there is a change with greater investment in prevention, we really need to be investing in what I think I would describe as quality prevention. I think, you know, the average person can really understand the bottom line of investing more in prevention, investing more in quality prevention, because it's just common sense. And now we need to translate that understanding into a powerful movement. You know, we've got to stop getting unnecessarily sick and injured so often. More and more people are fed up, and I think the time is going to be right for moving some of those dollars from illness research to prevention research, and from illness and prevention biologic research to a greater diversity of research, and from prevention, meaning brochures, beyond brochures, to quality prevention.
Larry, if a genie could grant you 3 health-related wishes, would you ask for?
I'd love to see health. I really would love to see health, not illness, when we talk about health care. You know, when people talk about health care, they need to be thinking about what can we do to keep people healthy. And, of course, that means creating the kinds of communities, environments, and policies that foster that for our families, friends, and everyone. That means practicing health is going to take into account transportation, food systems, safety, planning, economics and finance, and that the health leader is someone who's going to work with lots of non-traditional sectors rather than just providing care after the fact. And that's going to be cheaper, as well as really improving the quality of our lives. Secondly, and I think this really relates to the healthcare field, as we develop a new leadership, new doctors, nurses, public health, social workers, even planners, I hope they really get the importance of prevention and quality prevention, that they'll understand prevention on a systems level, not just one individual at a time. That's why we developed our textbook, Prevention is Primary. There really hasn't been a book aimed at students that talks about how to be effective in preventing illness and disease. It's been so long that since there's been a book like this, in fact, that what we're discovering, it's not only students, but lots of current practitioners are out there buying the book. And finally, of course, I hope we invest in prevention as seriously as we invest in treating people. You know, Prevention Institute, instead of being unique in the United States, that we become much more of a commonplace resource, and that there are copycats around the country, even across the world.
Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. I hope that this is of use.